Please the court, I would like to introduce my colleague who will be making the argument, Richard Zuckerman of the firm SNR Denton. And sitting next to him is his partner, Mr. Peter Wolfson, of the same firm. The court's, of course, familiar with Mr. Clayman, who represents West Point, who is sitting at the council table.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Martin Lesner on behalf of the appellant plaintiffs below. At council table, I have Bruce Bennett from the firm of Dewey LaBeouf, who will make the argument today. Also have Richard Thomas from Young Conway.
Welcome.
May it please the court. This is a breach of contract case and a breach of fiduciary duty case. The contract at issue is a registration rights agreement, and the breach of fiduciary duty arises from the controlling shareholder self-interestedly stopping the registration process in an attempt to retain control of WPI, a Delaware corporation. The case began a long time ago with an order of a New York bankruptcy court compelling the secured creditor, which held first or senior liens, to accept illiquid stock rather than payments of cash in satisfaction of the secured claims. And as required by the order that granted them the illiquid stock, the defendant, WPI, entered into a registration rights agreement, which it drafted, no one else negotiated. The contract at issue here to register the stock and permit a sale in the public markets, and that should have allowed the plaintiffs to get cash. The registration was to occur as promptly and as expeditiously as practicable. Both those words are words used in the registration rights agreement itself. At all times, the plaintiffs were entitled to sell illiquid stock. Now, the defendants try to make a point that at different times in the proceeding, plaintiffs alleged that they were secured creditors or that they were alleged they were stock owners. But that was a function of the differing rulings that were coming out of the New York courts. The bankruptcy court originally ruled that as a result of the sale, the plaintiffs became stockholders. When the district court heard and decided the appeal, the district court determined that their status of secured creditors had never changed. They were secured creditors, albeit secured by stock. When the Second Circuit ruled, the Second Circuit agreed with the district court ruling that the bankruptcy court erred, but said that the Second Circuit was prevented and the district court was prevented from granting the relief the district court granted. And so the Second Circuit said, you're stockholders again. I think an important point here is that the registration of rights permitted the sale, or was supposed to permit the sale of stock in the public markets, whether pursuant to a foreclosure as a secured creditor or whether the stock was held directly. It didn't matter. And also, at all these different points in time, the plaintiffs had a significant amount of stock. They might have had more or less based upon the rulings of the district court or the Second Circuit at the end of the day, but the lion's share of the stock they were going to hold, they held at all times. There was no stay pending appeal at any point in time or any stay of the obligations under the registration rights agreement. And so it's crucial that they would have had the opportunity, maybe early on, to sell this huge amount of stock.
Well, there was a stay under the stipulated stay order, if that's the right terminology.
I understand.
Of the distribution of the second lien holders, the junior lien holders stock. Isn't that correct?
What the state stipulation says, and I think the words of the stipulation turn out to be very important, is that the distribution was being made, but the distribution was being made into escrow. And you're exactly right. And they were subscription rights, not actually shares. Once the subscription rights were in escrow, they were going to stay there until there was an ultimate determination. And I think this goes to the impossibility argument, or it's been called different things at different points in the proceedings.
Well, I just want to make sure I understand. As far as the second position lien holders are concerned and their subscription rights, under the interpretation of the stipulated stay order by the Second Circuit, that distribution was postponed. Correct. It didn't take place until after the Second Circuit.
The ultimate distribution to the holders was postponed because they were in escrow. That's exactly correct.
And the contractual obligation to register is tied into the distribution, correct?
Well,
Correct.
That changed, that ruling changed, of course. Even if the right to registration was keyed to the distribution date, that's a defined term. And the stay stipulation says that the distribution into escrow was the distribution. The stay stipulation says the rights are being distributed to the second lien holders and distributed into escrow. It does not say that the whole mechanics of the transaction was to go on hold. And, of course, we know that the defendants understood that because after the stay stipulation was entered, what did they do? They proceeded to register.
Okay, so your position is that under the stay stipulation, the distribution of the rights, whatever rights the second lien holders had, took place in the form of the escrow. Is that right?
That's correct. The distribution was made and then held in escrow.
But the Second Circuit didn't validate that.
The Second Circuit opinion uses different language in different parts of the opinion. We've pointed out the sites where the Second Circuit says the distribution was made but made into escrow, and then in other circumstances they use the word distribution to refer to the stock coming out of escrow.
Well, I guess that raises this question. What, if any, significance should we give to the Second Circuit's treatment of this whole question of distribution, at least as far as the second position lien holders are concerned?
I want to say, number one, fundamentally, the Second Circuit didn't have the registration rights agreement before it at all. And all of the other decisions it's making based upon, really for other purposes. I think if you take a look at line up all of the sites to the word distribution in the Second Circuit opinion, and we've tried to do that for you in our reply brief, although some of it may have been in our opening brief, you will see that the Second Circuit, when it confronts the question directly, talks about the distribution having been made into escrow as being the distribution for purposes of all of the operative agreements. It then uses the word distribution, and I'm going to say small d. It's the same word, but uses the distribution to describe the rights coming out of the escrow. This, of course, is not helpful. But I think when you read all
in order for us to validate your position, we would have to accept your interpretation of the Second Circuit's interpretation of the stay order.
Yes, you would. Or frankly, that you could also determine that the Second Circuit wasn't focusing on this and wasn't making an interpretation of these particular words.
Well, for whatever reason.
Purpose. Correct. Yes, you do.
And if we don't accept your side's interpretation of the Second Circuit's interpretation of the stipulated stay order, it would follow, would it not, that the distribution didn't take place until after the Second Circuit ruled?
That would be correct, but I would point out that
in which case the registration rights didn't get triggered until after the Second Circuit rule.
Well, I would make two observations in connection with that. Number one,
a yes or no before.
Yes, that all those things follow.
Okay,
but I would say first of all that Justice the Chancellor in the first ruling on summary judgment determined that there was no precondition, that the distribution date was not a precondition to the obligations under the registration rights agreement. But secondly, that interpretation of the stay stipulation, which is completely at odds with the actual language that's used in the stay stipulation, would have had the effect of suspending registration from the day the day the stay stipulation was signed. And it's hard to believe that anyone thought that was the case because all the effort that was put in registration after the stay stipulation was signed. So if that's an interpretation that is all of a sudden being embraced by the appellees, that's a new interpretation of the stay stipulation.
Question. If we were to hold that the registration rights under the agreement, that is the contractual claim, fails, does that dispose of the appeal, or do we also have to reach the fiduciary duty argument independently?
I don't think the fiduciary duty argument would still be there independently.
Well, what?
The fiduciary duty argument is an argument that would apply if they wrongfully stopped the registration process. If they were entitled to stop, if the corporation was entitled to stop the registration process, that comes within your relatively recent case on this point.
Um,
Now, you have not used yet the phrase that the Second Circuit has, that this was a single integrated transaction.
Well, the Second Circuit uses the word single integrated transaction to refer to the entire sale. They do not use the phrase integrated transaction to say that the stay stipulation was integrated with the sale transaction. And I think that is the shift that is made in some of the papers that creates a problem. The stay stipulation was after the sale was completely done and all the documentation was done and approved by the bankruptcy court. It's a separate freestanding document that you would interpret in accordance with its four corners. Of course, is informed by what the parties did with it after it had been executed. So I think that there's a lot of confusion in some of the papers about what integrated applied to. But the Second Circuit never said that the stay stipulation was integrated with any other document. And in fact, the stay stipulation itself says it's not integrated with any other document. It is the single statement of all of the terms related to that agreement. I want to spend a minute on the fiduciary duty claim because in the event that Your Honor's rule that the contract claim is still alive, the fiduciary duty claim should also be alive. And first of all, it's really important to note that this is a case where the fiduciary duty claim is asserted against different defendants than the contract claim. This is not a case where they are completely duplicative. There are certainly cases that have been decided that deal with completely duplicative claims. And I think the most important point I would leave you with respect to that issue is that a fiduciary duty to not interfere with a registration process that was already ongoing would apply whether or not the corporation started the registration process by reason of an agreement or whether it started the registration process because they thought it was good to have liquidity for the minority shareholders. And, of course, there's a case that's really closely on point. It's from 1994. It's the Hamilton case where a corporation had registered its shares not pursuant to an agreement. And then the board, really the controlling shareholders, caused the board to cease registration. And they said to save money, but the allegations were to pursue an ulterior motive. And, of course, the court in that case found that there was a fiduciary duty not to stop the registration of the shares or not to stop the reporting with respect to the shares for an ulterior purpose. I think that case is right on fours with this particular fiduciary duty claim. So if the corporation had a contractual obligation to register, was in the process of registering, which is actually the facts of this case, even after the stay stipulation was entered, to terminate that right in order to entrench control because the shareholders didn't like a decision that had been reached in the intermediate appellate court, does state a breach of fiduciary duty and is a breach of fiduciary claim. I also want to zero in on the impossibility question because I think the impossibility question is also a key to understanding what was going on in the stay stipulation. First of all, the registration rights agreement is one agreement. The stay stipulation is a separate agreement. They are not integrated agreements. The integration language in the Second Circuit opinion had nothing to do with this question. Nothing in the Second Circuit agreement says they're integrated. So you had two separate agreements, one of which the registration rights agreement says there's going to be one registration, and then there is an interpretation of the stay stipulation that says there might be two distributions, and that was the subject of our questions before. And so the question becomes, well, what do you make of that? And what the Chancellor made of that is said, well, I'm just going to not enforce one of those two conflicting commitments. And, of course, the best case on this, because it's as explicit as can possibly be, is the W.R. Grace case decided by the United States Supreme Court. And there, too, in related circumstances, W.R. Grace found themselves subject to two different inconsistent obligations, and breaching one or the other might have subjected it to damages. And the Supreme Court said, well, if you do subject yourself to inconsistent obligations, that's your problem, not either of the parties you've made promises to. In Grace, by the way, the circumstances were really bad because Grace had a choice of either paying people for not working or keeping too many people on the payroll. What we point out here in our briefs, I think fairly carefully, is that there were lots and lots of ways to eliminate the inconsistency without harming anybody. There was no law against, no rule against two registrations. There was also no law against or rule against extending the effectiveness of one of the registrations in order to encompass the second event. that would have just required amending very slightly the terms and conditions of the rights that were tied up in the escrow for the period of time during which the case was working its way through the appellate courts.
Let me ask you to clarify that. Are you arguing that in effect we could hold that there were two separate distributions? That is, there was a distribution that took place very early on to the first lien holders, but consistent with the Second Circuit's opinion, the second distribution to the second lien holders took place after the Second Circuit ruled, and therefore the registration rights were triggered as to the first lien holders but not the second. Is that your argument?
It would be triggered with respect to all of them at the first time, and the problem is how long would the effectiveness be? And what I'm saying is that
there's only one distribution for purposes of registration rights.
Correct. Right. So at least that's the contract, and that's what the contract said, and that's how I think you would link them. That's how I think you would link them together, and they would fit. Going back to the integration question with respect to the state stipulation and the registration rights agreement. There's a lot of things that are undisputed about that show them separate. They were done at separate times. They have separate parties. They were each approved by separate courts. They're on separate pieces of paper. As I indicated before, they say very clearly on their own terms that the two agreements state the entire subject matter with respect to those agreements. So they are separate and freestanding agreements. And to integrate them creates all kinds of problems that, quite frankly, aren't there when you read the documents separately. I'll save my remaining time for reply.
May it please the Court, I'm Richard Zuckerman. I'm honored to be before this Court to represent the appellees. Disconnect from reality is a phrase that the Court used in a hypothetical during the prior argument, and I think there's no more apt phrase to characterize the contrarians' argument before this Court. The contrarians embrace an untenable view of what the Second Circuit held and its impact on this Court's decision, on the Chancellor's decision, and then on this Court's decision. The contrarians ask this Court to ignore the positions taken by the contrarians in the Chancery Court over 4 years of litigation prior to serving the modified third amended complaint, the fifth version of their pleading. And the contrarians even asked the Court to ignore the transaction documents, the registration rights agreement, the asset purchase agreement, and the other transaction documents that formed part of what the Second Circuit called an integrated transaction. And the specific phrase that the Second Circuit called to lay to rest the issue of whether the stay stipulation was separate from the integrated transaction is the Second Circuit said, quote, the stay stipulation permitted the transfer of assets and the lien release, claim satisfaction, and distribution to occur as a single integrated transaction, unquote. They were intrinsically linked together. The Chancery Court properly considered all of these things. The Second Circuit decision, the transaction documents, the prior proceedings before the Chancery Court.
And all of those things argument, are just to make it clear, at least to me, is that the Second Circuit, the proper interpretation of the Second Circuit's interpretation of the stipulated stay is that the distribution was postponed. That is
absolutely, Your Honor.
And that being the case, since there's only one distribution, there was no triggering of the registration rights.
That is correct, Your Honor. The specific phrase that the Second Circuit used, and there were different places where the word distribution was used, but we regard the dispositive phrase in the Second Circuit's decision as it states, quote, and this is at page 252 of the Second Circuit's decision, it states, quote, the stay stipulation withdrew the stay on the closing of the sale and replaced it with a much narrower stay of the distribution of the second securities, which is the Second Circuit used the phrase second securities to describe the subscription rights that were placed in escrow. Second Circuit goes on, thus, quote, as specifically set forth, unquote, in the stay stipulation, the contrarians lost the right to seek remedies that roll back any element of the sale. So the distribution only occurred after the Second Circuit decision in the fall of 2010. There was no obligation to proceed with registration in 2005, which is when registration would have taken place had the contrarians abided by their obligations under the stay stipulation and limited the remedies sought on appeal in the district court to reallocation of the escrowed subscription rights.
If we were to agree with that position, would it dispose of this appeal?
Yes. The Second Circuit's decision brought to an end 5 years of federal litigation arising out of a 2005 bankruptcy court sale order. There had been two bidders at the bankruptcy court sale, our clients, the Icon Group, and on the other side, the contrarians. Both the Icon Group and the contrarians had been secured lenders of the debtor West Point Stevens before the bankruptcy. And there were also other first lien lenders and other second lien lenders. At the auction, each party bid for control of a new company that would hold the assets and own the assets of Stevens. The Icon Group made the highest bid. It was accepted by the bankruptcy court. Under the sale order, the Icon Group formed West Point International, a new company, to be the owner through a subsidiary, West Point Home, of the assets of Stevens. The Icon Group also paid new money, $187 million worth of new money, as part of its purchase of control. Under the sale order, the first lien lenders and the second lien lenders were to receive securities in the new company. The first lien lenders would receive parent shares and subscription rights, and depending upon a valuation, if there was enough left over based on the valuation, the second lien lenders would receive subscription rights. And there was a registration rights agreement, which forms the crux of the appeal taken by the contrarians. The registration rights agreement provided that after distribution occurred, and not just after distribution occurred, but after distribution occurred in accordance with the sale order, which meant distribution of all the securities to first lien lenders and, depending upon the valuation, to second lien lenders, and distribution free and clear of liens. After distribution occurred in accordance with the sale order, International would proceed with a registration statement. The contrarians appealed the bankruptcy court's sale order, at first sought a stay on appeal of the entire sale order, which would have stopped the closing of the transaction, and then withdrew that application for a stay and entered into what the parties have called the stay stipulation. The stay stipulation was a withdrawal of the right of the contrarians to seek any remedy other than a reallocation of the escrowed subscription rights. By withdrawing the application for a stay of the sale order and allowing the sale to close under Section 363M of the Bankruptcy Code, the contrarians accepted the fact and agreed that the only remedies that could be provided on appeal would be reallocation of the escrowed subscription rights. Now, the contrarians then promptly breached the stay stipulation. And I use the word breached because the stipulation is, of course, not only a court order when accepted and so ordered by the court, but is a contract between the signatories. The signatories included the contrarians, Aritex, West Point International, and West Point Home. So what did the contrarians do? The contrarians went to the district court and said, don't restrict the relief to reallocation of the escrowed subscription rights. Instead, turn the entire sale order upside down. Impose a lien on virtually all of the securities in West Point International. Deprive the Icon Group of the control that it purchased. Keep the securities that were placed into escrow locked up. And allow this entire bundle of securities, all subject to a lien, to be subject to further proceedings, lien foreclosure proceedings on a remand to the bankruptcy court.
Your clients obviously oppose that.
Our clients opposed that relief in the district court and abided by the stay stipulation.
And was one of the grounds for your opposition that it would breach the original agreement?
We argued in the federal courts that the stay stipulation did not permit the district court to afford that relief, and we argued successfully in the Second Circuit that the stay stipulation did not permit the district court to afford that.
I understand,
relief.
But you're making an argument here that one of the parties to a contract breached the very contract
that is correct,
that was seeking to enforce. And my question is, that breach argument, was it advanced to the district court as one of the grounds for opposing the other side's motion?
It was not put in terms of a breach of contract, because the issue didn't arise that way. It was put in terms that the stipulation does not permit this. The Second Circuit agreed with us. The Second Circuit said, quote, as specifically set forth in the stay stipulation, the contrarians lost the right to seek remedies that roll back any element of the sale. So while the Second Circuit did not address the question of was this a breach of contract, one, as a matter of law, a stipulation is a contract, and two, the Second Circuit specifically held that under the stay stipulation, the contrarians, quote, lost the right to seek remedies, unquote. That, without saying that, was the Second Circuit didn't say that means they breached the contract, but that's the only conclusion one can reach from the Second Circuit.
Okay, so the argument, the breach of contract argument, or the argument couched in breach of contract terms, is being raised for the first time in the state court, that is, in the Chancery Court proceedings, but it's grounded on subsidiary findings that were made by the Second Circuit.
Absolutely, Your Honor. In effect, while the breach of contract argument was raised for the first time in the Chancery Court, we have the benefit of issue preclusion based upon the specific findings of the Second Circuit that the contrarians lost the right to seek remedies beyond reallocation as part of the stay stipulation. There are, in fact, three separate reasons, and we've touched, I believe, on two of them, as to why the contrarian's registration rights agreement fails. Their registration rights claim is a contract claim, and the contrarians fail to plead and cannot prove three critical elements. One, whether the obligation under the contract arose and whether we breached that obligation. The obligation under the contract did not arise because the distribution had not taken place. Two, the contrarian's own performance, and that goes to the question from the court that I asked a minute ago, and that I responded to a minute ago, which is the contrarian's own breach of the stay stipulation. The contrarian's own breach of the stay stipulation prevents the contrarians from pleading and proving an element of a contract claim under New York law, the plaintiff's own performance of the contract. That's not simply an affirmative defense under New York law. It's an element of the contract claim. And third, causation. The contrarians cannot plead, and their prior proceedings in the Chancery Court absolutely negate any claim that the fact that the registration did not go forward until after the Second Circuit's decision caused any damage to the contrarians. Let me address each of those very briefly on the ones that we've touched upon, and then let me focus on causation. The distribution did not occur until after the Second Circuit's decision. That had intensely practical impacts here, because had West Point International attempted to go ahead with the registration back in 2005, while these federal proceedings were going on, neither the non-contrarian first lien lenders nor the second lien lenders would have benefited from the registration. And as Chancellor Chandler properly held, one should not construe a contract to deprive the parties of that contract of the very benefits under that contract. The reason why the second lien lenders and the non-contrarian first lien lenders would not have benefited from a registration back in 2005 was because of the contrarian's own conduct. Through the contrarian's conduct, liens were imposed on all of the securities, including shares and subscription rights, both those that had been distributed to the first lien lenders and those that had not yet been distributed but were put in escrow that had been allocated to the second lien lenders. Had the registration gone forward, the first lien lenders, the non-contrarian first lien lenders, and there are 11 of them, the contrarians don't, when I say non-contrarian, the first lien lenders who are not within Aritex and not within the contrarians, would not have benefited from the registration because under the sale order, under the asset purchase agreement, under the registration rights agreement, they expected to get securities that were free and clear of liens so that when those securities were registered, if they sold them, if any individual non-contrarian first lien lender sold them, they would get the proceeds and have the right to retain the proceeds. That's not what would have happened. The registration wouldn't have worked. The benefits would not have gone to the non-contrarian first lien lenders because there were liens. So if the registration could have gone forward, and there's grave doubt that it could have, but even if it could have gone forward, the non-contrarian first lien lender, which sought to sell its stock, its now registered stock, would not get the proceeds. The proceeds would be subject to the liens that had been improperly imposed by the district court at the request of the contrarians that breached the stay stipulation. The position of the second lien lenders included that problem, which is that the escrowed subscription rights were subject to the liens, but the more basic problem that the distribution hadn't yet taken place. In a registration statement, one has to list who the selling security holders are. Who were the selling security holders? It was unknown because the securities that were allocated to the second lien lenders weren't distributed and were instead placed in escrow. So it simply would not have worked to go forward, and the distribution date not only did not occur until 2010 and thus trigger the registration obligation at that time, but that's not just a theoretical legal issue. That's an intensely practical issue, an intensely legal issue in terms of how it would have actually worked here. The contrarians' own breach of the stay stipulation I've addressed. I mention it briefly simply to note that while, as Your Honor pointed out, the Second Circuit did not directly address the breach of contract issue, the specific findings of the Second Circuit, that the contrarians lost the right to challenge any aspect of the sale order other than a reallocation of escrowed subscription rights, meant that they were prohibited from doing that by the stay stipulation. And the stay stipulation is a contract that leads inexorably to the conclusion that this was a breach of contract. The third element of that the contrarians would have to establish to prove their contract claim is causation. And here, it's not the Second Circuit's proceedings, but it's the prior proceedings in the Court of Chancery that negate any possible claim by the contrarians that the fact that the registration did not go forward until 2010 rather than going forward in 2005 harmed them in any way. And that's true. It's no matter how one construes the contrarians' somewhat hazy and ambiguous claims on this issue. It's not quite clear what the contrarians say they would have done had registration gone forward. Had registration gone forward, would they have sold the specific securities that were allocated to them? Well, they told the Chancery Court they wouldn't do that. They told the District Court they wouldn't do that. They told the District Court that they did not even own those securities, that they viewed themselves merely as holding a lien among the group of first lien lenders on those securities, and they disclaimed ownership in those securities.
Well, what, as to the issue of causation, isn't the focus on what is in the pleadings?
That is correct, Your Honor. But in construing the pleadings in the fifth iteration of a complaint filed in the Court of Chancery, the Court of Chancery is entitled to consider and properly considered the prior verified complaints, all of which are sworn pleadings, all of which negate the claims in this fifth iteration, the modified Third Amendment complaint. In the prior complaints, what the contrarians sought was Court of Chancery approval of foreclosure proceedings so that the contrarians could foreclose on a controlling interest in a majority of international stock. That's exactly what they stated they were seeking. They also included, as part of the proposed foreclosure proceedings, a specific statement that the stock was not registered. And, in fact, the registration of the stock would have been utterly irrelevant to a foreclosure of a controlling interest in the company. So what the contrarians made clear to the Chancery Court from 2006, when they commenced the action, until 2010, when they tried to regroup in light of the Second Circuit decision, is that they would not have sold the securities that were allocated to them as part of the 2005 sale order, that they only wanted to foreclose on a controlling interest, and that they would not even foreclose on a controlling interest until the Court of Chancery approved collateral disposition procedures which would govern the foreclosure sale. That is properly considered on a 12B6 motion addressed to a third amended complaint, or what's called a modified third amended complaint. In other words, the allegation, to the extent that in that modified third amended complaint the contrarians are alleging, if they had been registered, we intended to sell them, the Court of Chancery is entitled to look at the prior proceedings and say, that's not what you've been telling me for 4 years. And this is an allegation as to your own intent. This is not an allegation to some unknown fact where somebody, a party, might be able to plead in the alternative because the fact was not within their control and the fact did not go to their own conduct or their own actions. These are the contrarians pleading, this is what we intended to do. And the Court of Chancery properly answered that question, no, you didn't. The other aspect of the contrarian's claim of causation, which is utterly negated by both the Second Circuit proceedings and the prior proceedings, is to the extent that what the contrarians are claiming is that had the stock been registered, they would have proceeded with a foreclosure sale of registered stock, and that somehow that might have been better than the foreclosure sale that they were trying to seek of the unregistered stock. Then the contrarians are seeking damages for something which the Second Circuit has held they had no right to do. If the contrarians are saying, we would have been better off, we would have foreclosed unregistered stock, the answer to that is very simple and is properly given on a 12B6 motion. You didn't have a right to foreclose on a majority interest in this stock, registered or unregistered. Please read the Second Circuit's decision. That was a lien improperly imposed by the district court. So on each of these reasons, and I note that these are three separate and independent reasons that negate the contrarian's breach of contract claim, the registration rights claim, there's no obligation. The obligation hadn't arisen. Therefore, the obligation was not breached. It is barred by the contrarian's own conduct, and there's no possible causation under any way that it's viewed, because that's barred by both the Second Circuit and the prior proceedings in Chancery Court. That claim is, again to use the phrase, a disconnect from reality and was properly dismissed on the 12B6 motion.
Mr. Zuckerman, I have a question that relates to each argument. Less than 30 minutes ago, the other side argued that there was a distribution because the securities were placed in escrow. In the beginning of your argument, you said there was no distribution because the securities were placed in escrow. Now, those, are rather irreconcilable statements from each side. Is distribution a defined term in either the contract or in any stipulation that would be a source of resolving the difference in the respective parties' position?
Yes, Your Honor. Distribution, the phrase that's actually a defined term is the phrase distribution date. And distribution date is defined as, and I'm paraphrasing, Your Honor, but I can draw you specifically to the...
Well, if it's in a defined term section, I'll find it. So that's my real question.
It is a defined term. The defined term is specifically referred to in our brief. And to paraphrase it, it is defined as the date upon which the securities, and this is all of the securities, are delivered in accordance with section, and I believe it's 3.3C, of the asset purchase agreement. And what that means is that all of the securities must be distributed, and all of the securities must be distributed free and clear of liens. And the only way, I respectfully suggest, Your Honor, of reading the Second Circuit's decision is that the distribution did not take place. The Second Circuit said that what happened was that there was a, quote, stay of the distribution, unquote. The Second Circuit then, in directing what should be done on remand to the district court and then to the bankruptcy court, said the distribution should now be done, not the prior distribution should be undone and there should be a redistribution. The Second Circuit said the distribution should now be done and then set forth the formula for making the distribution, again making clear that the distribution had not yet been done.
Thank you.
Let me very briefly address the fiduciary duty claim. This is a make-weight claim. There was no contractual obligation. If this court finds there was no contractual obligation, as counsel conceded, the fiduciary duty claim fails. If this court finds that there was a contractual obligation, the fiduciary duty claim also fails because there's no fiduciary duty under Delaware law to proceed with registration of stock. If there was such a duty, it could only have been grounded in the contract here, and therefore the fiduciary duty claim would be dismissed even if whether or not the contract claim survived. For these reasons, Your Honors, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the Court of Chancery. Thank you.
Thank you.
First, as to Your Honor's question concerning where the distribution issue might be resolved, the first place I direct your attention to is the stay stipulation itself. The relevant paragraph is paragraph 3. And here's what it says. It says all the parties, I'm not going to list them, agree to support the district court entering a stay of the distribution of the subscription rights allocable to the second lien lenders pursuant to the sale order without any requirement that a bond be posted on the following terms. And here it is. The second lien distribution to the second lien lenders shall be made at the closing. That's the closing of their integrated sale, but shall be held in escrow. That says to me the distribution occurred, but the results of the distribution were being held in escrow. That would be the first place I'd look. And remember, the stay stipulation is written after all of the other agreements are done. So all the other definitions are in, and people are writing the stay stipulation. That's the way they wrote it. Everyone, an agreed document. Now let's go to the Second Circuit, because right around the same passage that was read by opposing counsel, there are other passages. Here's what they say. I'll give you the exact cite in a second. To this end, the stay stipulation provides that the distribution of the second securities, their defined terms, to the second lien lenders shall be made at the closing, same language here, but shall be held in escrow until, among other things, the escrowed funds are ordered to be distributed. So once again, the Second Circuit's words, when they focus in on these mechanics, say the distribution is happening, but the things being distributed are being held into escrow. A few paragraphs later, in particular, the stay stipulation required that the second securities be distributed to the second lien lenders, but that such distribution be held in escrow. There, the Second Circuit uses the word distribution twice. It says it's happened, but the distributed property is going into escrow. So if you read the stay stipulation itself, then the language of the Second Circuit, you can see, I think, rather clearly that the Second Circuit believed, but most importantly, all of the parties to the stay stipulation believed that what they were doing was making the distribution and providing that some of that which was distributed was being held in escrow. That's what they were intending to do. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the causation issue and the assertion that there are somehow any inconsistent statements in the record. And here's the most important point. When you look at the complaint that was filed in Delaware, the one they're referring to, August 2007, long after the registration rights process had completely stopped, there was no longer the possibility that there was going to be a registered sale. They weren't pursuing registration anymore. So the relief that was being requested in the Chancery Court was for the Chancery Court to establish foreclosure rules in an environment where The securities weren't registered. There was no hope that they were going to be registered, and that was a pleading that was filed after the district court had ruled. The district court had ruled the status of the plaintiffs was as secured creditors, and so the allegations, again, in August of 07, long after the breach, are allegations of these are the orders we need from the court to determine how to foreclose in this environment. There was never any inconsistent statement by any of the plaintiffs or any of the other holders of first lien loans initially and shares issued in respect of first lien loans ultimately that said, we don't want to have a registration and we're not going to sell in a registration. They all wanted the opportunity. They all responded to the solicitation by the defendants, were who's interested in the registration? Give us your particulars, your names, how many shares you want registered. Everybody sent that in. And as Your Honor correctly pointed out, the law in Delaware is very clear. The issue is having an opportunity to make a sale. And it's certainly not parked before you, but when he's talking about practicalities, any early sale would have been fantastic compared to any later sale in terms of what happened to this company subsequent to the closing. It was straight downhill from the beginning to the end. So we can't, without a hearing, decide what people would have done when, if that's even an issue. And it's not an issue under Delaware law. This is clearly a New York law contract. New York hasn't spoken except in defining Florida law, and they found Florida law in a vacuum to be the same as Delaware law. That the key is when someone agrees to give registration rights, they're giving an opportunity that someone may well avail themselves of. They're entitled to the opportunity. If they've been deprived of the opportunity, they have a right to recover. I want to go back to the questions asked about the breaching of the stay stipulation. Your Honor's right. There is no complaint about a breach of the stay stipulation until we get back to Delaware after the Second Circuit has ruled, and all of a sudden they have a new idea. And the facts of this are pretty important. As we pointed out in our papers, I'm sure we pointed out in our papers, that the appeal brief to the district court was on file before the stay stipulation was entered into because an expedited appeal has been sought. It was there for everyone to see. It was perfectly clear exactly what arguments were being made, what issues were being made. Every aspect of it was already in type, already filed. And there was nothing in the stay stipulation that says anything other than, except as specifically provided here, nothing was specifically provided, the appeal goes forward. There was no motion for contempt for violating the stay stipulation. There was no motion to strike any portion of any pleading that was filed in connection with any of the appeals. None of that. And effectively, what defendants are arguing is that we've already been, the plaintiffs have already been adjudged to have breached a contract without a trial, without any pleading arguing to that effect, and this all happened on a motion to dismiss. We submit that there is nothing at all that supports the idea that there was a breach of the stay stipulation, and as indicated before, the conduct of the defendants, again, are most telling about what people were expecting as a result of the stay stipulation.
Well, you said the stay stipulation came after the appeal, and the record supports that. The stay stipulation also said it was entered without prejudice to any rights you were asserting in the appeal, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Without prejudice to all the rights that we were, if the brief was already, I think that was my point. I misstated the exact words, but the brief was already on file. Everyone knew what we were asserting in the appeal already. It wasn't a mystery.
Well, but there are two things. They might have known what you were asserting, but to the extent you were asserting it and you didn't want to give it up, they knew that also.
Exactly. So I don't think there's any support for the idea that there was a breach in any way of that particular stipulation. As to the elements, I think we dealt with causation. I think we dealt with the point that there was no breach because the brief was on file and no one ever complained of it. And I also think that in terms of did the registration rights were triggered, again, it was triggered no later than the distribution date. And I think the stay stipulation is perfectly clear that the distribution date happened when the distributions were made, including the distribution that was made into escrow. And while you can find some language in the Second Circuit opinion that talks about the distribution out of the escrow as being a distribution small d, when you look at the Second Circuit's characterization of the distribution that was made under pursuant to the stay stipulation, the language in the Second Circuit opinion is as careful as the language of the stay stipulation. It says a distribution has been made, but what was distributed was put into escrow. I think that's all I have. I think that the an important point to remember is that everything here is de novo. This was a motion to dismiss, effectively reversing a motion for summary judgment, which was remarkable in and of itself. The pleadings contain all the requisite allegations. The Second Circuit opinion didn't take this case away from the plaintiffs, and it's their only possibility of recovering anything in respect of a loan that started out as fully secured and a loan as to which their liens were stripped improperly. Two appellate courts said that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.